Welcome to the Choose Your Own Adventure podcast, a place to have authentic conversations about the things in life that really matter. All right, welcome back to the Choose Your Own Adventure podcast. I am Russ Cothers, and with me is Tony Kriz.
That's me.
So I was going to start this episode off just by asking Tony kind of how things have been going for him. He's got a new book coming out in January.
Yes, I do.
Yeah, recently I saw the kind of early review by Randy Woodley.
And yes.
Looked like a pretty positive endorsement.
Embarrassingly so. Positive, yes.
So yeah, I wanted to hear about that. And then I know you spoke recently at a conference in Seattle. I wanted to hear about that too.
All right, where should we start?
So I want you to talk about the book a little bit. What's going on with that?
Do you have that endorsement in front of you, Wes?
I do not have it in front of me, but okay. I can pull it up very quickly.
So yeah, Aloof's new book, Aloof. Subtitle is Figuring Out Life with a God Who Hides. And I'm sort of in the process. I just got what are called media galleys. So it's a not fully edited, but like 99.9% edited versions of the book. They actually print a full book. It looks exactly like a book, but it's got like media information on the inside and on the back. And they send those out to radio stations, TV stations, you know, different media outlets, and then also to people to get them to endorse it, write about it, talk about it, that kind of stuff. So I'm also in the process of collecting some endorsements from kind people who read the book and say what they think about it. And Randy Woodley, who's a Cherokee man, a theological leader. He's a professor at George Fox Seminary and an unbelievable human being, was gracious enough to take a book, and he had a day later, he sent me an endorsement. And did you find it?
I did.
You just want to read it out loud since you've got it in front of you?
Yes. So this is from Dr. Randy Woodley. My friend Tony Kriz always asks courageous questions with uncharted answers. Often Tony does not have the answers to his own questions, at least not fully, but he has a strong hunch that the answers are important to us all. That's what makes him brave. Tony understands what is important in life, daring to make us think beyond Sunday school boxes and religious rhetoric, waiting patiently for God to emerge from those difficult and sometimes dark places. Tony also understands the sacredness and power of story. In Aloof, Tony Kriz asks difficult questions and shares sacred stories that find their way into our souls, drawing out our hidden questions and helping us to voice our sacred stories. Tony's style reminds me of someone. Sometimes his words are in red. Very cool.
Yeah, too cool. Too cool. And then I've gotten several now at this point, but I got another one from, do you know who Frank Schaefer is?
Oh yeah, I love Frank Schaefer.
Okay, so Frank Schaefer, son of Francis Schaefer, who now works mostly in the secular world as a political pundit on CNN and, you know, MSNBC and tons of stuff. But dear human being, very super, he's just so kind to me. I can't believe it. But he wrote this. Tony Kriz is a writer who happens to write books related to God. This sets Tony apart from the bevy of theologians who write only to communicate their ideas. Reading Aloof is a pleasure. People will debate the ideas, is there a God or not? But no one will put this book down feeling cheated. It is a work of art.
Mm.
Yeah, this is where it gets embarrassing.
Well, I can certainly echo those thoughts just having read your stuff myself. So,
and I should try and get you a copy of one of the media galleys, Wes.
Oh, I would love it. Definitely. That's awesome. Yeah. Frank Schaefer. He's the kind of guy I put you and him in a similar category as far as the willingness to kind of, even though he works in the secular world, as you said, but he's willing to kind of go to the places that, you know, people don't want to go, even in the secular world.
Yep. Yeah. He's really courageous.
Yes.
And then you asked about the conference. The last conference I was at was, well, actually, two conferences ago was the Christ in Cascadia conference, which I think is the one you're asking about.
Yep.
Up in Seattle. It's a new movement that Fuller Seminary has started, sort of a theological think tank around issues specifically affecting Cascadia. And Cascadia is actually a real place. It goes all the way from like lower Alaska into Northern California, mostly to the west of like the Cascades and the Olympics. And what it is just it's a unique sort of cultural pericope of folks that are going through some unique things spiritually and culturally. And this group is trying to ask questions about what does it mean to be people of faith, thoughtful people of faith, dealing with unique issues and perspectives that are coming out of this area called Cascadia. And it was a good conference. Tons of people were there, and there were presenters from basically every faith-based higher education institution in the Northwest, all the way up into Canada. So it was pretty great.
Very cool. And then you said there was another conference since then?
Oh, and then, yeah, the Good Samaritan Ministries had their weekend banquet conference for their organization. And I had a chance I was the keynote at that one, and that was really fun. They were extremely generous and kind. And so that was this last weekend. And nice. On Sunday, I fly to Missouri to Southwest Baptist University to speak.
Wow.
So, yeah, lots of excitement.
Yeah. Okay. Here is your first adventure choice.
Fantastic. On the Choose Your Own Adventure podcast.
Yes. So possibility one is a question about a faith other than Christianity.
All right.
Question two is about personality.
All right. So a faith other than Christianity. So we have dogs in the house. So right now you can probably hear my dogs in the background.
Yes.
And the second question about personality. I'm going to go with personality for 200 there, Alex.
Okay. So there is a personality tool called the Enneagram.
Enneagram.
And I know you are familiar with it.
I do.
And I am curious how the Enneagram has been helpful in your spiritual journey or otherwise.
Well, for those people listening, you need to know that this is a favorite topic of my friend Wes. So I have a feeling we're going to return to this topic time and again. But so the Enneagram is an ancient sort of personality test / spiritual development guide. And it's based on 9 different personality types.
Yep.
And Wes, you could probably describe it better than I can. But so I learned very quickly that I was an 8 on the Enneagram. Mm-hmm. And the way I describe 8s is 8s walk in a room and they see it as a playground that they can mess with. That's kind of how they perceive their world. And that's me. I'm somebody who likes to enter a room and I'm always asking, you know, how can we get into some stuff here? How can we ask the questions that no one is asking? How can we kind of play with all the sort of safe ways that we tend to behave? And how can we mess with people's social contracts that they live under? How can we play with those sorts of things? So that's an 8. And it's been helpful to me because one of the things with an 8, so I'm kind of a big personality guy, opinionated. 8s don't necessarily want to be in charge, but but a lot of times they're forced into roles of authority mm-hmm. because they are sort of big and opinionated often.
Mm-hmm. And you're comfortable in those roles, am I right?
Kind of. I think an eight would prefer to not lead, at least most of the eights I know. They would prefer to not lead, but they sort of reluctantly take those roles. Mm-hmm. What eights are really looking for is a leader that they can respect. Mm. So eights have a habit of taking down leaders that don't deserve to be in the role. Mm. That's sort of part of what they do. So anyway, one of the things about an eight is, and it's helpful for me, is when they're in a dark cycle, sort of going into their dark places, we all get into depression or insecurity or whatever. Mm-hmm. Eights can act an awful lot like fives, and fives are your ivory tower academics, love the world of ideas. And so what eights do is they tend to devolve into more like a five, and I do that. I become sort of an idea, and I use ideas to control my environment. I use words and ideas to control people and circumstances. That's evidence that there's something dark going on inside of me, and it's become a red flag for me when I see myself doing that, like wanting to argue too much or using manipulative rhetorical tools to put people down in really subtle ways. And that's become a red flag for me to go, whoa, something's going on. I need to stop. I need to go someplace and get quiet. Mm-hmm. I may need to read my Bible. I definitely need to meditate and think on God and do some self-care. Mm-hmm. Now eights, Richard Rohr says that eights can smell weakness, which is one of the reasons why they can take down leaders so easily, because they know where people's weak spots are. Mm. And so, but in that, when an eight are in an enlightened place, when they're in their sort of the best version of themselves, they actually behave an awful lot like twos, which is weird because twos are, they're sort of the servants. They're the ones who are always looking, like Martha in the New Testament is the classic two, always looking for things she can do or one can do for other people, like the background. But the thing about twos is they're the servants. They're always asking, how can I help? How can I support the people around me? And since eights can smell weakness, they know where everybody's weak spots, blind spots are. When they're in an enlightened, loving, compassionate state, they can really support people super well because they know exactly what every person needs to be their best, to be at their best. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So anyway, just like that understanding of what makes me dark or what makes me light and how I behave in those same those circumstances is really helpful to me. Mm.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, it's been a tremendous tool for me as well, both personally, and I've been using it with clients in therapy as well.
I bet.
And it just has such a diversity of, it's not static. It's not, there's other personality things out there that, they're okay, but I haven't found the level of engagement that you can have, the layers with it,
Yeah.
And it just seems to have, just more of that to it.
What number are you?
I'm a four.
You're a four. You want to describe a four for the listeners?
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a number of different kind of taglines they call the four. I don't think those are always necessarily the most helpful. But the big thing with four is kind of authenticity and meaning. We really kind of, that's what we're all about. And when things, we tend to see what's missing in the world. And so we can, kind of our dark side is when that's all we see, seeing what's missing is good. We need to see that. But when that's all we see, that's a problem. So the red flags for me is when I start getting really kind of negative on everything. And all I'm talking about is the darkness and the bad things and everything that's not going right. That's when I have to kind of check myself and say, okay, you're doing that thing again. And the thing with the Enneagram that's cool is it's this kind of one phrase that's used about it is this kind of non-judgmental self-awareness.
Mm-hmm.
So the point isn't to beat myself up when I realize that I'm doing that. It's just to kind of be aware that I'm doing it.
Right.
Which then gives me the freedom to actually make a free choice. And that's what's cool about the Enneagram. It puts you in this position to where before I didn't have this category to kind of step outside of myself and look at myself. And so I just would do things. And I still do that now when I'm not present. But now I have the possibility to be present in a way that I didn't have before, to where I can see myself almost as if it's not me.
Right. And now, I thought fours were driven by being special.
Yes, that's one of the... Unique. Yes, that's one of the pieces that are with it. But meaning is kind of where meaning is also part of that too. And I that language is more helpful for me than the unique language. That's definitely there. And I can see, you know, lots of places in my life where that is true. But I tend to be more conscious of kind of the authenticity piece and the meaning.
And we playfully refer to it as the precious butterfly type.
Yeah. In fact, I remember the first time I had a conversation with you about the Enneagram. You had some various different ways of describing each of the numbers like that I hadn't heard those before.
Well, eights are the a-holes. So that's the tagline for the eights. So
right. And that's what you referred to yourself as. And I was like, wow, that's a new one. I hadn't heard that one about eights.
All right. You got another one?
Okay. So possible adventure number two is, how do I want to phrase this? So the first one's just atonement theory.
Gee, me Christmas. Okay.
And the second one is Old Testament versus New Testament.
Oh my gosh. I'll take Old Testament versus New Testament.
Okay. So the question is, how do we reconcile the sometimes violent and genocidal God of the Old Testament with Jesus?
I would say that we don't.
Ah. And why do you say that?
Yeah. You know, the Bible is 66 documents. The word Bible means library. That's what the word means. Mm-hmm. 66 separate documents of people trying to explain what they see in the world, and while being inspired by the Holy Spirit to write. And the distinction between some of the energy and perspective, we have to remember that these books were written 1,000 years apart, sometimes 1,500 years apart.
Yep.
Between those exact Old Testament passages and the Gospels when they were written in the first century. And I do hold to conservative dating of writing of the books. And just think of the different perspective we might have on trying to define the essence of America. I mean, we can't even have that conversation. America's only been around 200 years, so we have to find something else. The essence of Western culture compared to how we would write that essay if we were alive in 1000 AD and how we would write that in 2000 AD. Mm-hmm. Now, both would be totally truthful and honest, but the vantage point is so different that I want to go to each book and sort of be inspired independently by what that author, from a conservative interpretive standpoint, fairly conservative, what they were trying to describe and what it meant for them and how that inspired them and what it taught them about God and how it gave them a sense of their place in the world and how it defined the undefinable all around them. Mm-hmm. These large, large meta concepts, people groups, interacting with people groups, warfare and purpose and hope. And what does it mean to work? And what does it mean to, you know, whatever, be married, raise children, these sorts of things that they're all wrestling with in their own time and place. Mm-hmm. I personally am far more drawn to the sacrificial, peace motivated, even towards nonviolent motivated passages that I find in the scriptures. Like when those do inspire me in a very, very specific way. But I'm also living in a privileged context. Mm-hmm. I'm not living 4,000 years ago, 3,000 right. years ago in a tribal context.
Yes.
So it's sort of very easy for me to want to focus on those nonviolent, turn the other cheek kinds of orientations. I know I danced around your question a little bit, but that's as good an answer as I got off the top of my head.
Okay. So basically you're saying we don't reconcile them in that.
We let them be the stories that they are. Just let them be the story.
Yep. Yeah. And I totally hear what you're saying. And I think as I've come to understand the ancient world, particularly, you know, radically different way of life, way of seeing the world, you know, anything you can think of was different.
Yes.
And we can hardly conceive in a 21st century Western America, you know, what that even was.
Right.
So I think it's enormously helpful to, you know, have some of that context when you're looking at those stories.
Yes. I mean, the Old Testament writers, they don't even blink when they talk about how many wives someone has and yep. how many concubines.
Yep.
You know, doesn't even blink. A concubine was essentially a sex slave.
Right.
It just, they don't even blink. But by the New Testament, they would absolutely blink at any of those ideas.
Yes.
You know, very specifically stating things like husband of one wife as a phrase, is like a foundational phrase, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's just 1,000 years apart. You know what I mean? And yet the New Testament seems to just kind of blithely include narratives of slavery with no social commentary along the way. Like, this is just a reality. This right. is how slaves should treat their masters, and masters should treat their slaves. And now, 2,000 years later, we're like, what the heck are you talking about?
Yes.
How can you possibly do that?
Yes. Yes, and even more so with some of the Old Testament stuff, you know, where God is basically killing the entire world except for a couple people. And yeah. how do we look at that as well?
Yeah, I love it when people decorate their baby nursery with a Noah's Ark. You know, and I imagine they do so because they think, oh, what's more lovely than a zoo on a boat? What can be more great for my kid than a zoo on a boat? You know, I'm like, that's a story of genocide. Yeah. What the heck are you doing? That's unbelievable.
Yeah. And yet it's a story that, you know, I was taught is factually true, and that's God. And, you know, again, how do I reconcile that with turn the other cheek, love your enemy, do good to those who curse you, right?
Right.
All this stuff with Jesus. So I know for me, having the possibility of looking at those stories differently than the way I was taught has been enormously helpful.
Yes.
And that's not always super okay in certain Christian circles.
Yeah, maybe this is kind of a postmodern thing, but, you know, growing up in the 80s and probably even into the 90s, the most important thing was to figure out some logical, philosophical way to make all those things work together. That they seem different, but they're really the same thing. They're really the same ethical perspective
yep.
from Genesis to Revelation. So there's entire books on reconciling the apparent inconsistencies in the Bible, right? Mm-hmm. And now I'm just to the point where I'm like, I'm going to read each story. I'm going to dive into each story fully, not only read a story to figure out how it compares to something that was written 1500 years later. Like not always being sort of up above the stories, like looking at them from 10,000 feet. I'm going to climb inside each one and be in it and try and experience whatever that writer and that community of people under the full inspiration of the Holy Spirit, what they were going through and what it felt like to be them and what I can learn from their experiences.
Yes. Yes. Love that. And in that particular story, you know, understanding there were other stories being told around that time about floods and that there were gods who were very angry about different things. And there really wasn't much redemption in those stories.
Yeah.
But in this story, there's redemption and God even feels bad about it.
Yeah. And there's drunkenness and nakedness too at the end, which is always makes for a good movie.
Right? Yes. There's lots of that stuff in the Old Testament. That's great for movies. In fact, have you seen the previews for the Exodus movie?
I mean, no, I haven't seen anything.
Yeah, I can't remember what it's called, but it's Christian Bale and somebody else. And Christian Bale, I think, he's either Moses or Ramses. I can't remember which one he plays.
Yeah, but I haven't even seen the Noah movie. Have you seen that?
I did see the Noah movie.
Any good?
You know, it was so outside of anything that I would have ever thought about how that story would be told. But I think it's worth seeing for that reason. Because the guy is basically, you know, he's taken this story that, you know, we all know and just putting a different perspective on it that kind of makes you rethink the story in a pretty profound way, really. And you might not, and even if you don't agree with him, I mean, he's obviously taken creative license as a film director to, you know, tell this story in a different way. But it's Aronofsky who did it, and he's, you know, the stuff he does is pretty interesting. I don't know if you ever saw Black Swan or Requiem for a Dream. Those are both his movies, but those are pretty interesting films, I think.
Yeah. So, hey, here's I just thought of something that you'll find interesting. So at the Christ in Cascadia conference, to jump back to that.
Yeah.
I went to one seminar that was discussing gender in mega churches and how gender plays out. And I won't get into all of it and I won't get into all of it. But one of the speakers, a lady who's a postdoc student, is doing research on, and I don't even know if she's a churchgoer. I don't even know if she's a person of faith, or at least Christian faith. But she's doing her doctoral work, some of it on gender and Christian worship music. And so I was like, okay, I'll sit through this. I think this was interesting. And she was, so she's doing this research. And so, you know, I was like, okay, I got a kind of an idea what this is going to be about. I think, you know, gender language within songs, is the language gender inclusive, blah, blah. No, she went a totally different direction. Her research is around, and she's using like much larger music theory stuff that she's bringing into the conversation. So she started out by talking about how, okay, she used one particular church and was analyzing their worship bands. They have a lot of worship bands. And she was pointing out how this particular church has a very, very strong, it's Marcel, a very strong sort of gender hierarchy within their practice. And every band is, she said, is led by a man. And the man always has the center of the stage during singing. And I thought, okay, that's not that insightful. And then she's like, and then all the power instruments, which she called power instruments, are almost always played by males. Lead guitar, drums, keyboards. Women only play secondary instruments like horns, that sort of thing. And they're always placed in sort of secondary spaces on the stage as a way of sort of, she would say, acting out or living out the gender theology.
Huh.
Now, the part that really kind of got my brain spinning, and I'm not even sure if I completely buy it, but I thought it was fascinating, and she's been doing a lot of research on it, is she actually pulled up some songs, and she walked us through them, not based on the words directly, but on literally how the music is structured. I'll try and explain it. So she pulls up this one song, and she says, okay, so notice that during this verse, they're singing theology. So it's in the third person. God is good. Well, I don't know what she was, but God is good. God is great. We love God. God's amazing. God's creator. God's whatever. Like third person about God, talking about God, doing theology through music, right? And on the verse, and she said this was very consistent across the music. On the verse, the song was written right in the middle of the male range, where the male's voice is as strong as it can possibly be. And the women were singing secondary roles, and they're all singing out of the middle of their range, where they're more breathy or weak or don't have as much power to their voice. But the male really has a strong sense, I own these ideas, very sort of proclamational in the tone quality. You tracking with me?
Yeah.
Then she goes, but when you move into the chorus on this particular song, it changes from third person to second person. It goes from being theology to talking to God, or the language of actual worship, engaging God. God, you are. God, you are. God, you are, right?
Right.
When they move there, the range of the song moves from the middle of the male range to the upper part of the male range. So as the male is singing, they are naturally straining as they say the lines, giving the revealing the male's strong, passionate desire for God as they strain to sing the words because they believe them so deeply. God, you are, and you are with us, and blah, 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 right?
Uh-huh.
But on those parts, the women are brought right into the middle of their range where they sound – this was her interpretation, right? They're sort of the least passive, passionate, or the most passive in those parts. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And so, I just gave you 3 minutes of what for her was, it was an hour long lecture. And then it was all based on a 230 page report she'd written on it.
Wow.
But anyway, just that concept that, and I don't know about what she would say, but I would say it's, if that is true, assuming that that's true, I think a lot of that stuff just happens. We don't even realize we're doing it.
Oh, for sure.
You know, it's not like some manipulation tool, like how do we put men more on display? Right. It just sort of naturally is the men are the primary songwriters. They tend to write things in this way.
Yeah.
And it comes out on stage. And it'd just be interesting to explore how many of our theologies come out in these secondary ways that we never even realize. You know,
yes.
My theology of the poor comes out every day in how I live and walk, interact with people. My theology of the non-Christian comes out in 1,000 different ways all the time. My theology of God's provision and what I worry about, that comes out in 1,000 ways I don't even see, you know? So anyway, I just thought that was a fascinating little lecture.
Yeah, that is fascinating. Did she have a final kind of conclusion about what that meant from her perspective?
Well, she wasn't, there's obviously a lot of commentary, and in commentary there is judgment of a certain kind, but she really wasn't trying to make this is bad.
Okay.
Her research is to show how gender theology manifests itself in all aspects of worship within a sacred context. That's what her research is around. And I thought it was just really interesting categories.
Yeah.
I wish I could give her credit. I don't have her name off the top of my head, so I apologize if you're listening. You were wonderful.
Well, maybe if we can figure that out, we'll put it in the notes.
Okay.
No, I think that's fascinating. And I think the unconscious processes as a counselor, I think about that kind of stuff a lot.
Yes.
You know, and I think a lot of what we do, and I think it works both ways too. Like, I think our unconscious, whatever influences that influence us, certainly, you know, are unconscious. But then I think when we're taught certain things, specifically that comes out too.
Yeah.
In different ways, right? Like if I am taught that God hates certain people, that's, I'm going to live that out.
Yeah.
Right. If I really believe that, or if I'm taught that he, you know, he favors this group over everybody, or whatever it is, you know, those things matter and they're significant. So I think research like that is really insightful and can be helpful in many ways. Well, thanks everybody for listening to our third episode. It's good to have you. Enjoyed it a lot. And we look forward to seeing you next time on the Choose Your Own Adventure podcast.
Thanks, everybody.
If you'd like to leave comments, questions, or submit topic suggestions, please go to cyoapodcast.wordpress.com.